Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are tackling once again a subject we cover a great deal, but one that grips this city and grips the nation, which has to do with the images that happen, the reality that happens, of what people call of police brutality in our communities. Another video popped up last night that happened out of the club Melba, and that has gone kind of viral across, as has the video that happened earlier in this year that came out during the winter when an officer was on a screen being shown punching a man in the face who they were taking into custody. So these, and then of course Ferguson. This conversation is intensified with Ferguson and with the family of Tyrone West, who's been on the show numerous times in their efforts, as has Commissioner Batts and more. So we are going to wrestle with this here. And now there is a bill in the city council for officers to be wearing cameras. That has its own controversy with it that we'll talk about as well. And we are joined here in studio by Bob Cherry, who is president of the Baltimore's Fraternal Order of Police Lodge number 3, at least for the next several weeks.
That's it, Mark.
Until he goes back to active duty.
Back to work. Jason, real work.
Jason Rodriguez joins us, who is one of the co-founders of the Baltimore chapter of Cop Watch. Councilman Nick Mosby is with us, who represents the 7th District in Baltimore City. Though he's not the original sponsor of this bill, he supports it and has joined us on air. It was good to have him. And shortly, we'll be joined by Delegate Jill Carter, who represents the 41st District, and introduce Christopher's Law. And, of course, all of you at 410-319-8888. Please write to us here, talk at steinershow.org. You can also log on to our Facebook pages, tweet me at Mark Steiner. When you hear your thoughts on the issue of cameras and more, 410-319-8888, what is this notion of excessive force? What does it mean? Shelley Greenberg, who runs the Hopkins Center for Police Leadership, could not join us today, but he wrote an extensive email with lots of thoughts, and I'm going to raise some of those thoughts here that are complex about this and see what our guests think about that. So welcome, everyone. It's good to have you with us. Nick, welcome. Good to have you with us, man. Let me start with you.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
Always great to have you with us, and I appreciate your constant willingness to come in and talk to the people and the listeners here at WEAA. That means a great deal to our listeners. But Nick, so you're not an original sponsor of this bill, but it seems like every city council person is on board. And explain from your end, but the mayor has criticized it, which we'll talk about. Talk about the parameters of this bill and what it's saying.
Yeah, well, the bill is just basically saying that at the end of the day, to have audio and video coverage of interaction in our communities is critically important to ensure that, one, the proper job is being carried out, but also, two, to protect the officers. And it's just another layer of insight that we see. And, you know, I mean, you look at the amount of police-involved incidents. You look at the amount of lawsuits against the city with the police. You know, this is just another insight for the police department, for the citizens of Baltimore, to know that exactly what's going on when you deal with police-to-citizen engagement.
And I'm curious what your thoughts are on police wearing cameras, Bob Cherry, and I have a very direct question for you as well after that.
Well, first, I just want to say good morning, Councilman Mosby.
Hey, Bob.
Good. How you doing, sir? I think, Mark, and I commend Nick and President Young and the council for wanting to engage this as they should, representing the citizens of Baltimore. But, you know, I got to give credit to the mayor here. I think that, you know, what Stephanie's looking at here is the police commissioner is the one who's charged with setting policy in the police department. And as such, he really needs to be the one responsible for figuring out where do we go with these body cameras. I mean, I think, you know, it seems to be like the talk right now across the country that most chiefs want to go to body cameras. And last year I was invited by the Police Executive Research Forum to participate in a similar dialogue like this. And it was interesting to hear chiefs from all over the country having different takes on what the cameras do, both the plus and the minus. I think, as Councilman Mosby stated, you know, there's definitely positive for our offices because in so many circumstances, our offices are doing the right thing. And people will lie about what we did to effect an arrest, as we saw in the video last night, which, by the way, I think is very different from the video that was shown with the officer who allegedly assaulted the guy at Gray Mountain North. I think it's two totally different videos. But I think in one way it does do that, and it does hold our offices accountable. But you got to look at, you know, cameras from two different viewpoints. And I think that's where the mayor is saying we need to slow down and first think about this and let the commissioner decide where he wants to go with this policy. And I look at it from two ways, both a practical and a philosophical viewpoint. The practical, Mark, is this. The camera's only going to give you one viewpoint. It's only going to, you know, if the camera's on the officer and it's facing forward, obviously it doesn't give you a 360, you know, a full view of what the officer and his or her partners are going to see. The camera's not going to measure the psychological or the, you know, the impetus what's going to force the officer to take action, because the camera just records in a two-dimensional format what it sees. You know, if I get a camera facing you, but to the corner of my left, I see your producer, Mark Gunnery, doing something back there, I may now turn my focus there because I see a threat behind me. You're not going to see that in the camera. So I think from a practical standpoint, cameras aren't, you know, the end-all solution to reducing police brutality or giving us a full viewpoint of what we just occurred. And then the other side of it, I'm kind of surprised at a lot of the Democrats on this air and the New York Times and the ACLU, because I'll say this, you know, where are we now? You know, 2 years ago we had a major discussion on the NSA and recording every one of our phone calls. And there was a lot of concern about privacy. Where are we as a society that you want every police officer across the country videotaping everything that you do? You know, not every encounter, Mark, with an officer is going to be negative. You know, you and your wife call an officer to your home because you want to report drug dealing down the street, and now I have to inform you and your wife that I'm recording you, because remember, this is a two-party state. Maryland, like Virginia, has a two-party consent. And I'm in your home, and I'm recording what's going on with you right now in your home. Do you want all that being stored in a government database?
And I'm going to come right back and let Jason respond to that and have another direct question for Bob. These very difficult questions here. I'm going to talk about these two videos that happened in Baltimore. Really want your thoughts at 410-319-8888. Police officers have called before. We want to hear your voices. People have called from the community many times in this program to talk about what they've experienced with the police. We want to hear your voices. 410-319-8888. Please join us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Voodoo Child, Jimi Hendrix. On this day in 1966, Jimi Hendrix arrived in England, where he would meet the rest of his band and create the Jimi Hendrix Experience. As part of our Music Day in History, a little Jimi Hendrix. Back to reality of Baltimore City, and all the people calling in now at 410-319-8888. As you wrestle with these questions of police interactions with our citizens in Baltimore, the question of cameras, the two videos that have popped up recently that have raised a lot of issues, and people's own personal experiences. We're here with Delegate Jill Carter, Maryland State Delegate in the 41st District, who introduced Christopher's Law, Councilman Nick Mosby, representing District 7 in Baltimore City, Jason Rodriguez, who is one of the co-founders of the Baltimore chapter of Cop Watch, Bob Cherry, president of the Baltimore's Fraternal Order of Police Lodge, number 3, and you all at 410-319-8888, Robert and Bakari and George, we're going to come to all your calls. And you can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages, or write to us at talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. Before we turn to Delegate Carter, Jason, I was going to ask you to comment on this camera issue quickly and then go to the delegate and kind of open the phones and really wrestle with this issue.
Good morning, everyone. I'm just really flabbergasted to hear Mark, Bob Cherry speak the way he was just speaking a minute ago, and really sounds like non-support of the camera system. When I hear him playing on people's emotions as far as homeland security and privacy is concerned, it's not a matter of what the cameras do, why the cameras do. It's a matter of when will we get these cameras to do what they do in our city. We know that in Tampa Bay, Florida, they're implementing these cameras. It's reduced our liabilities against the city. It's hold officers accountable. It's changed the demeanor of the department. It's made the officers more professional, professional when they're out and engaging in the public. So we know that these cameras work in many of the cities that they're being implemented now. And for anyone to sit there and play on our emotions as far as homeland security and privacy issues, I'm pretty sure that an officer going into a home seeing that there may be an indecent child. You know, I don't have a problem with an officer taking his hand and covering up the camera in a situation like that, or someone editing the film for privacy issues. We can address those issues. But to sit there and say that these cameras, you know, should not be implemented is a bunch of nonsense.
Delegate, let me let you jump in before we go back to Bob.
Well thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. And I may have missed some of what was said before, but I know that there's a great momentum and a great public outcry for these cameras. There's a lot of support for the cameras. It did come up in the last legislative session, and the House did pass the cameras bill. I believe it didn't make it through the Senate, and I think that we're going to definitely take a look at it again this year in Annapolis. I am a supporter of the concept of the cameras, but we can't do it we can't only rely on cameras. My concern is that we're going to get comfortable with, well, police officers have cameras and that's a fix to the problem, and not look at the underlying fundamental needs that we need to address as well, such as increased education and training. We need to increase education and training across the board from beginning, top to bottom, and throughout. A recent audit even said we need to increase education and training within the Internal Investigations Division. And so there's a lot of reaction to these two videos, but putting things in context, I've been practicing law, mainly criminal defense law, from the public defender's office to private law in Maryland, but mainly in Baltimore City, for 20 years now. And what occurred on those videos is alarming to the public, but it is not a surprise to me and other people that work in the field of criminal justice and criminal law. And it should not be a surprise to anyone in leadership. The mayor presides over the Board of Estimates. She knows what money is paid out on a regular basis for police brutality cases. So, and anyone that works in this field knows that this is not any kind of an aberration. I'm not saying it happens, you know, day in, day out in every case. But, you know, these issues go back, way back, even to when, in 1989, when the judge I clerked for, before I clerked for him, Judge Johnson convened a grand jury report about the issues of trust in the Baltimore Police Department, and there was no trust between Baltimore police and people. And it goes on and on. So I say that to say that you can't just talk about one issue in isolation, issue of cameras, or one issue in isolation, reforming law enforcement officer Bill of Rights. You have to look at it more broadly and address everything, each thing individually and collectively.
So this is a very difficult subject. I mean, for a lot of reasons. I do want to get the phones here, but let me just pursue a couple of things. One of the things was the videos that we were talking about. One of the things you said, Bob Cherry, was there was a difference between the two videos that we saw, the one in Green Mountain North and one at the Club Melba that took place last night. Was it last night? Last night.
I believe
last night. So I want to, and also interestingly, you used the word yourself, police brutality. You said we have to address some of the issues of police brutality. I mean, those were your words, not mine, what you just said. So when I looked at that video last night, what I saw was there was obviously an altercation, as was reported, between this man and one of the folks watching the club, the bouncers in the club. But when they tried to stop him, he kept walking. The question is, what does excessive force begin and end? When officers are kind of hitting him with clubs as he's walking, and there were at least seven officers in that photo, or five officers in that photo, would it not just be easy enough for officers just to grab a hold of him, put him against the wall, and handcuff him rather than beating him with clubs? And why, when he's sitting on the ground, does he have to be tased? I mean, are those things...
Well, first, Mark, I mean, it's interesting that some of the words you use, like beat, I mean, that wasn't the case. There were five officers at the scene. But look at what we're looking at here. I mean, you're talking about a club at 2 a.m., where there was a fight. The officers are on foot, which a lot of people, Councilman Mosby would agree with this, we want more of our officers on foot being proactive and dealing with some of the issues we have in the city. When you referred to it as an altercation, it wasn't an altercation. This suspect was ordered under arrest. And if you look at the very beginning of that part of the video, you see him coming towards the three officers who are trying to effect the arrest. The other two officers are now trying to deal with the crowd that is gathering, which is also a threat to all the officers there. And, you know, you ask about, you know, how far do you go? We have in the police department, every police department across the country has a continuum of force that is allowed to be used, and it starts with a verbal command. Mark Steiner, you're under arrest. but at some point I have to put my hands on you to effect the arrest. And then from there, the continuum will move forward to, you know, hands and some of the, for lack of a better word, the martial arts training that our police have, to their rasp, to their pepper mace, all the way up to their sidearm, depending on what type of a threat you are. And I think that's a situation there. What you're not talking about, Mark, though, is once the arrest was effected, and by the way, as the police department rightfully pointed out when they slowed down the video, I don't know if I would have showed that video, because let me say this. Everyone has cell phones now. Everyone, you know, that there are city watch cameras everywhere. Are we going to start now doing like NFL replays of every single arrest in Baltimore City if it's a lawful arrest and I have to use some sort of force? And that's what our officers did two nights ago at Club Melbourne on Greenmount Avenue. What I wanted to say is, if you notice when the officer fell, one of the officers fell beneath the suspect whose arm was right around his gun belt. Now, if he gets a hold of that officer's weapon, Mark, he's not just a threat to that officer and the other four who were there trying to effect the arrest, but to people like you and your wife or Delegate Carter who may be walking up and down Greenmount Avenue. Once the arrest was effected, he's in handcuffs, they rendered aid. I think that was a completely different video than the one that was shown a few nights ago or last week from Greenmount and North.
Well, yeah, Mark, if I could jump in real quick. Nick,
go ahead, because I have to leave 11:30, yeah. So please jump in.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that we lose the importance of the discussion around cameras when we talk about specific incidents such as this. I mean, because at the end of the day, there's a whole lot of facts that will go into the case, some of which that we probably don't know at this point. But at the end of the day, Bob earlier, I think he articulated some of the complexities about the implementation of the camera system. But in doing so, I think that on both sides, whether it's the citizens who really want it or, like, say, the FOP who think it's not the necessary thing to go in, I think that we know that there's definitely a distrust in our community as it relates to interactions of police departments and urban settings, not just in Baltimore, but throughout this entire country. And the one thing that we know is that what the cameras will do is provide a video and audio perspective of it. It doesn't provide every angle. It doesn't provide every perspective. However, it does provide something that can be in combination with the police reports or with the witness testimonies to just provide an eye view of video and audio to directly kind of articulate that. There's been many times where, unfortunately, the witnesses or the folks on the scene, their testimony is completely different than a police report. And what this does do, again, is not only protects that to ensure that we can continue to kind of push forward for justice for all, for the police officers as well as for the citizens that they are there to protect and serve.
So let me, I'm going to open the phones here. We'll turn to Jill first after we open the phones here. 410-319-8888. Delegate Jill Carter is in the studio with us as well. And Robert in Baltimore, you're on the air. Robert, you're on the air. Welcome. Robert, you there?
Hello?
You're on the air. Can you turn down your radio, please?
Oh, okay. Give me a second. Yeah, just a second. All right. I'm going to knock this radio out. Hold on.
All right. Don't hurt it, though.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I want to look at it from the other end. If I'm understanding the debate, and maybe I came in a little late, but if I'm understanding the debate, it's a question about the desirability of the police having the cameras or what have you. But I'd like to ask about, and maybe you might consider this off topic slide, but what about the possibility of citizen groups who should, in fact, perhaps be monitoring the police themselves? The question of who's directing the camera is not insignificant.
This is an important question. Let me push this a tad further, Jill Carter, what Robert just raised. The Reverend Heber Brown was on the show recently. He's on the show a lot. One of the things he called for was the creation of citizens' patrols to monitor police behavior and shoot what's going on in our communities. As he put it, similar to what the Black Panthers did in 68, but different because we're in a different era with different technology. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's a good idea, and I think it's worth implementing. And I actually think that we have a constitutional right to do that right now. I don't think we need necessarily a law to do that. We have an absolute right to oversee the law enforcement in our community. Now, and that's, as citizens, we have a right to do that. But people have also talked about giving more teeth and more authority to the Civilian Review Board, an independent body, to have an ability to take a step further what is missing or what lacks, what IID lacks. And I think that's another part of the dialogue, too. So I think we already have a right to do that, and we should do it. It's something that we should do. I think that, too, when we talk about the officers having the cameras, it's critical that we know that the officers, that the police department is monitoring what the officers are doing, and they're doing it adequately, and that if the officers somehow fail to perform their duties with the proper use of the cameras, there are repercussions for that. Because what's to say, just because they have the camera, that they're using them according to what their protocols are, and that, you know, that there are some repercussions if they don't, to ensure that they're doing it properly.
And to push that a tad further, let me ask all very quickly this question, and then we're going to go to the phones. Another FOP president is on the line. We'll hear what he has to say as well as Bakari, Kay, and Kim, three callers. We're going to get to everybody here. 410-319-8888 is the number. But now other people have called for either a police review board, a civilian police review board, that might have more effect than cameras would, though cameras can be used as part of that. Because right now the board we have, the people who support it, say it has no teeth. It can do nothing. Heber Brown has suggested that we have at the every precinct level a community police review board that really puts it closer to the ground. What are our thoughts on that as a way to kind of begin to address these questions that come up over and over again? And I'll let you start, Bob, and I'll go to Jason and around
well,
the room.
In terms of community police review boards, you know, we do have one. Delegate Carter said there's a lot of people concerned that it doesn't have enough teeth.
It has no teeth. I mean, it might as well just...
You know, and Mark, it may not, but the fact that we have a review board in the city that reviews every complaint that goes through our internal affairs, I think it's still a step in the right direction. You know,
but should there be a review board that has subpoena power, that actually has power to do
Mark,
something?
Mark, let me just say this. You know, should we have a review board of citizens to review doctors and what they do with their surgeries? Or lawyers, and I mean, Jill, you're a lawyer. I'm not. Should I be telling you what you do, what you did wrong in discovery? I mean, I think.
But
you
there
know,
are processes in place for that.
I was going to say we have ethics standards and
right. And likewise,
and judges get filed papers on all the time.
No, and you're right, Jason. And likewise, that's what we have here in the police department. And let me just go right back, because actually, Delegate Carter, you said some good things. And Jason, don't. I mean, and let me just say this with the cameras. And I think in the beginning, Councilman Mosby picked up when I first started my conversation. I think there are pros and cons to it. I looked at it from a practical standpoint and a philosophical. The practical is the cameras still not give us every viewpoint that the officer has. But let me go back to what Delegate Carter said about training, about supervision. I think she hit it right on the head there. You know, relationships are built on trust. And despite what people want to say, I think we have come a long way with building trust in the community. Are we where we want to be right now? No, we're not, Jill. But you know what? We've come a long way. You know, 20 years ago, 10% of our officers lived in the city. That number is now over 30%. I live in the city. I think that there are officers out there, and I'm saying this as a union leader, who don't belong in the force. But guess who hired them? The police commissioner. You know, it's funny how the FOP, the union, not the police commissioner, not the mayor and city council, are the ones who want to raise the hiring standards so we put on the street young men and women who are from the city, who have an education and or military experience, and who will with incentives to live in the city. We support that, Delegate Carter, but we don't get the support we're looking for from the police department to implement those kind of regulations that I guarantee you, Jason, will increase the relationship and the trust that exists in the community.
So I want to go to Jason and then back to Jill and Nick before he has to leave in a couple of minutes. But so you're saying you don't think we need a stronger civilian review board?
I'm saying we have one, Mark. But you know, even if you gave them more teeth, I think there's always going to be some folks out there who say it's not enough.
Well, there's always, but that's it, not. Well, I mean, of course, but that doesn't mean you don't need one. That was the question. Do we need
right.
one? And Jason and then Nick and Jill, then we'll go back to the phones.
I think it's a necessity within our city, but we need one that has, you know, a little bit of teeth to it. We have to be able to present evidence to the grand jury and have access to the grand jury. You know, even if it means bringing it to our public safety committee chair people like Councilman Nick Mosby or Warren Branch, and bringing it up to them and allowing them to start an investigative process, you know. But right now what we have is a citizen review board that, one, is missing members, and two, has no prowess at all as far as trying to get justice for citizens like Tyrone West, Anthony Anderson, or even their own officers, William Torbett.
So, Nick, very quickly, I know you have to roll in a minute, so please have a final thought here about that.
I mean, at the end of the day, the basis of all this discussion, no matter what perspective you're coming from,
is that we understand and know there's a distrust between the police officers and the communities. The criminal justice system relies on the community. I mean, and when you have jury pools who are distrustful from the second a case begins on the officer providing the testimony, you have to put in those types of variables to ensure that you're creating more trust in the community. And, you know, the cameras, citizen restricting, citizen review board, looking at other operational procedures and policies must be at play to provide that. So I think that, you know, this is just a start. I mean, the cameras is just one variable, but there's so many other things that we have to tackle, and the citizen review board is definitely one.
Well, let me ask you what I just asked Bob Cherry before we take a break here. I mean, do you support or not support the idea of a stronger civilian review board, either at the community level by precinct or at a citywide level?
I support a stronger community citizen review board. I think that Mr. Sonny out of Bella Edison, he's been one of the main proponents for several years. I know that we had a hearing on it last year, but I mean, yeah, I mean, again, when we talk about growing up city, when we talk about the Baltimore that we all realize and know that's right at the cusp of obtaining, we cannot do it unless we have a stronger commitment and connection between our community and a police department. And the only way we're going to get there is by putting in additional variables to ensure that that trust grows.
Jill?
Absolutely. And briefly, we have, as attorneys, just by way of analogy, we have an attorney grievance commission that any citizen, any client can file a complaint against an attorney. Once that is done, the attorney grievance commission has an absolute authority to make an inquiry. The attorney then makes a response. No right to an attorney. No right. We have a right to counsel, but you know, you don't have to have benefit of counsel. Make a response. At that point, they have full authority to subpoena any documents, any witnesses. Full thorough investigation. If the complaint is substantiated and basically a sanction is in order, there's a penalty that occurs. Once that happens, our name is posted on the Maryland Judiciary site. It never goes away. What the act that was committed, that was done, and what the penalty was, it's there forever. And so talking about people, and the reason is because we are deemed to be in a position of public trust, not necessarily carrying guns and not necessarily serving and protecting, but whenever someone comes to us, they put their lives in our hands, they put their family in our hands, they put the quality of life in our hands. And so it's a very important thing. And I would say that's not even, you know, the life and death so much as being an officer. So I think absolutely there should be an independent body that has full authority to thoroughly investigate and to ensure the public trust, not just investigate, but to open up and have more transparency once there is a finding so that there's a repercussion. So one of the reasons that we want to stay on the straight and narrow as attorneys is we don't want to be posted on the Maryland Judiciary website so forever and ever, so that people say, oh, you know, she had that thing, you know. So it's a big thing. It's a big deal, and it can affect your business forever.
So,
and Mark, if I could jump in real quick.
Yeah, Joe, I do need to get to the phones here, Jason. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry, just real quick. I think that there, again, is additional complexities to this issue. But when we know, when we look at places like Baltimore City and the level of police enforcement in urban areas all across America, like Baltimore City, many of these issues are at a state level. And I think no the delegate could speak up and talk to this. But when we talk about the Law Enforcement Bill of Rights, when we talk about the way that the charter was crafted to establish police departments, many of that has to really take place in Annapolis. That's why I think it's critically important that at the local level we have and continue to have these types of discussions, but understand and know where the true action has to come from. It's really done in Annapolis.
On that subject, may I say one quick thing? Because we'll talk about more of this further as we go along, but that's why in Annapolis we are planning, as myself and members of the Judiciary Committee and Baltimore delegation, some possible reforms to Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights, a look at strengthening the Civilian Review Board, because all of these are pieces of legislation. And prior to session, November 22nd at 2 o'clock at University of Baltimore, we're having a pre-session public hearing to look at these issues.
So let me have the phones here. I want to go to Bakari first because he's been holding for 20 minutes. Then we'll go to James Shapiro, who's president of the FOP Lodge 34, called in. And Kay and Kim, we're going to get your calls when we come back from break, 410-319-8888. Bakari, take us a break with your thoughts.
I have Hey, thank you for allowing me to join you guys in comment. I just wanted to say I'm 29, born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland, and just as a citizen of the world right now, we give up so much of our content via social media and via just credit cards, cloud storage, all of these different things. And so I think that the gentleman that's on the show, I would love if you could repeat his name, but he's, you know, essentially contesting that we don't need to give up anything else. And I'm arguing essentially that we already give up so much that I think that having these officers wear cameras would be something that we could willingly give up. There's an article that's posted in The Guardian about Rialto, California, and once those officers started wearing cameras, their incidences of police brutality plummeted. I think they reported something like 88%. And so I think that it's worth a try, and I think that if the city is able to be honest about the average back as far back as 2008, the average $3.5 million that the city spends on police brutality-related cases, I think that we owe it to our young people to spend that money on them and not on careless officers. We know it's not all, but the few that are there, if those few are spoiling a bunch that comes to the sum of $3.5 million, I think it's worth us buying some cameras and making it come to an end.
Bakari, thanks for those thoughts. And you were referring to Bob Cherry, who's president of the FOP Lodge here in Baltimore City, number 3. So he can talk about that when we come back as well. I appreciate you being part of the show. We're going to take a quick break and come right back. We're going to go to James Shapiro, who's called in, who's the president of FOP Lodge 34. I'm not sure where that is, but we'll find out when he gets in. And we'll talk to Kay and Kim in Baltimore. Do not hang up, Kay and Kim. We're going to come back to you. Councilman Nick Mosby, thank you so much for joining us. Look forward to having you back on very soon again. We'll take a brief break. As we go out to the break, we're going out with Blind Lemon Jefferson. And break with the Black Snake. Black Snake Moan, I should say. He was born in the state in 1893, one of our great blues artists, Blind Lemon Jefferson. We'll be right back.
I ain't got no mama now.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way to our conversation, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union's banner is right there. We are here with Delegate Jill Carter, Maryland State Delegate for the 41st District. Councilman Nick Mosby was with us earlier. He had to leave at 11:30. Jason Rodriguez is with us, one of the co-founders of the Baltimore chapter of Cop Watch. Bob Cherry is with us, president of the Baltimore's Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge number 3, at least for the next 3 weeks when he's going back to active duty. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let's go right to the phones. And we said Shane Shapiro is on the phone, who's president of FOP Lodge 34. Shane, welcome to the program.
How you doing today? FOP 34 represents the Maryland Transportation Authority Police, men and women. Just real quick about it, it's not a Baltimore City issue, but it's about the cameras in general. You know, this is a new type of technology. The first time you saw it was with the tasers. Then now everybody wants to jump on the bandwagon as soon as something bad happens and say cameras, cameras, cameras. But I think professional sports have proven the cameras don't show every angle like Bob Cherry showed. And I think that's something for the councilmen, councilwomen, delegates, senators, and even other elected officials to think about, because, you know, you start putting these cameras on police officers, and the fact of the matter is it doesn't show everything, because it depends on how close that officer is and how good of pixel that camera has. And I think it's very important that before you go and jump in to buy this new technology, that you wait and make sure that it's vetted out and see all the different types of cameras. Because let's face it, you watch a Ravens game and they do a challenge, you know, the refs go and look at the camera and they see what they think to be is every angle, but it's really not, because it doesn't show everything. You know, go back and look at some of the professional games. And now, but you're putting that on a police officer who has less than a split second to make a decision whether to fire their firearm, use their taser, pepper spray, use their baton in a situation that could change their life for the rest of their career and also their family's life, because a civil lawsuit can really hurt an officer as well if the department doesn't back them.
I really think that's a poor analogy using sports cameras as you know, reference. Sports cameras do not have point of view angles, and the type of technology that is being used in police cameras that is being implemented across the country are more point of view cameras. So it's seeing what the officer's eyes are seeing. So this false fallacy of, you know, we're not going to be able to see every angle, you know, it's going to be interpreted differently, you know, like there's going to be some sideline referees making decisions. It's a bunch of nonsense, because that's not how the technology works, and it's a misnomer.
Well, actually, that's not true, because there was an episode out in the Midwest where an officer wore a body camera on his shirt pocket and got into a shootout in a chase, and when he exited his vehicle, the camera was flopping all over the place, and you couldn't see the suspect with the firearm in his hand that he was firing upon.
That's one type of technology, but they also have other types as well. They also had head visors. They also have sunshades. They also have other devices as well that are just as capable of keeping up with the action as well.
So, I mean, there are a lot of questions about the cameras, obviously. I appreciate, Shane, if you calling in before we go back to the phones. But Jill and then Bob, I think, and then go back to the phones here. There has to be something that can be used, and the cameras can be used for. I mean, many officers are saying, other officers have said, that these cameras are there to protect the police as well for saying they've been falsely accused. I mean, isn't that also part of this?
Absolutely. And so, you know, it's difficult to understand resistance, just, you know, philosophical resistance on the part of police, because basically we consistently say that these kinds of measures protect good police. These types of measures protect the integrity of the profession. And so, of course, there are going to be sometimes glitches in the system as we move forward and we make progress, and it's somewhat new technology and new to us in using it. But that's always going to be the case. But the overwhelming belief that it's going to be more beneficial than detrimental is, well, that's what we believe. And so legislatively, you know, I can't say what we're going to do because I don't control the legislature, but I think it's likely that we're going to pass something similar to what we passed last year, even maybe a little stronger than what we passed last year. And then it's up to specifically Baltimore City and other jurisdictions to decide the specifics of how they're going to implement it. But we already passed legislation last year in the House, and now, you know, now that there's no blocks in the Senate now, it'll probably pass the Senate, and so we'll probably have the camera legislation to require it for police across the state. So it's going to be up to the individual jurisdictions. I think for Baltimore, we have to look at making sure that we get the best technology, making sure that we spend our money wisely, and making sure that we put proper protocols and education and training in place, and that we have the adequate ability to monitor, and that we just do it, you know, we do it effectively.
Delegate Carter, I think in the very beginning there, you said you're surprised at the resistance from the police.
There would be.
But you know what? I wouldn't refer to it as resistance. I think, you know, and I started my conversation out when Mark first started the show with giving credit to the mayor. And I think she's more in line with what we're saying is just, let's just first just slow down and look at this as a total picture. And I hear what you're saying too, Jason. The technology is going to continue to change. Maybe the cameras will get better over time. I think what Shane was trying to say is that they still only provide a certain viewpoint. They still don't give every angle. They definitely don't measure the psychological impact on the officer on why he or she chose to do what they did. Think about this, too. I mean, what we're trying to do here is look at the total picture. I mentioned about the event I went to, Mark, last year that was put on by the Police Executive Research Forum, which is primarily an organization of professional police officers, mostly chiefs. And they put out recommendations on cameras and so forth. They published a 92-page document on this. And one of the things that I learned from there, besides, you know, speaking in terms of, like, slowing down and taking a look at this. And by the way, there were people like Commissioner Bratton from New York there, Chuck Ramsey from Philadelphia, Kathy Lanier from D.C., who all agreed that this is where we're going, body cameras on cops. But even they agree, you know, we just can't just rush into it like the city council bill that exists right now that's 2 pages long and just says put cameras on every cop. Does it talk when you turn them on? Where is it going to be stored? How much is it going to cost? Who gets access to it? There were some chiefs in the South who were at this PERF event, the Police Executive Research Forum. They went to cameras, and now they're pulling them off of their offices at the request of prosecutors. Because what they found is, for whatever reason, if an officer did not have a camera on or did not capture the crime or the arrest that they effected, the juries were less likely to believe the testimony of the officer on the stand. And I think that's where we as a profession, and that's where it goes back, Mark, of me pushing for better standards. Policing, like attorneys, Jill, like doctors, like radio jocks, like Mark, it's a profession. And I think that if we as a YouTube generation only want to believe that, oh, if it's on a video, I'm not going to believe it. What happens if I get out? Well, let me finish though, Mark. What if I get out of my cruiser and I see a robbery occurring real time at a bank and I chase that suspect down, but I forget to turn my camera on, if for whatever reason that's a policy that BPD goes to, and I effect an arrest, you go to court, and Greg Bernstein's line attorneys put that case on, but for whatever reason the juries are afraid to...
It would be now Mosby's or never done, depending on who wins the election. But
I mean, think about it.
Right.
These are some of the, I think, this shows the complexity of the issue is a lot more than just looking at it through the prism of police brutality. Because, hey, Jason, I'll give you this. There is no doubt. I mean, there has been studies that have shown when cameras are put on police that the allegations of brutality or assault go down, which is a benefit for us. Because what it does is it backs up the police officer's version or story.
Yes.
All we're saying, though, it's a lot more than just the camera.
I agree. But I think that it's not something that should take forever, and we could figure it out rather quickly rather than shortly.
Correct.
And also, I think in a situation like that, there's likely to be backup. So even if the one officer forgets to turn the camera on in the heat of the moment, there should be another one there that has one or two. And that's to be meted out the individual case in the litigation. So I understand what you're saying. But, you know, that's what I mean. I pretty much said the same thing, that there's going to be situations like what's going to happen if an officer, you know, when they turn it on, when they don't. I was actually concerned some years ago when we decided that for all interrogations and capital cases, they had to be recorded, because I thought about those same issues, you know, because officers pretty much control and decide when to turn things on and off, and that could be an issue, what happens before and after.
So let me – I want to do this. I'm going to get several callers in here very quickly so we can kind of respond to them. And I have a larger question I want to ask the three of you before we get out of here. 410-319-8888. Kay, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning, Mark Steiner.
Good morning, Kay.
I want to address your guest directly. First of all, I want to start out with what he said off before, comparing the cameras to terrorists and all this type of stuff. I'd like to clarify for every ear that can hear, the first and the real terrorists in the world. They were white, they were Christian, and we were known as the Ku Klux Klan. They have never been disbanded, and I do believe in my heart that they're all in the judicial system, and they are about 90% of the policemen. Number two, I lived in three major cities in my life. I have never, ever seen black policemen in the white suburbs. Number three, this is a phenomenon that exists all over the United States. The first camera I believe that caught it was the drunk man that they beat up that caused the riots in the Watts riots. I can't remember his name.
Rodney King.
That was the first one. Now, for this man to stand here and say that's going to be detrimental to the police, it's only because they want to continue their sadistic campaign of genocide and murdering black males, which they've done. There was one more case I want to just back up what I'm saying about the police and their mentality towards black men in the South. I do believe it was... Well, this old man that had helped murder Medgar Evers years ago, I believe one of the jail keepers down there said so many niggas had been killed in there, the jail smelled the nigger blood, okay?
All right. So, Kay, thank you so much. We have a policy at the EA that that word used cannot be used on the air here. 410-319-8888. Kim, you're on the air.
Is it Tim or Kim?
Kim.
All right, Mark.
Welcome.
Look. I'd just like to say that, you know, as this program started, I was really on the fence about cameras on officers. But just hearing how evasive the gentleman is from the FOP, it's just really raised my antenna to this issue. I think as another layer of integrity to the process with police and citizen interaction, it's got to be something that's needed. It could be a win-win for everybody, as well as police and citizens, to protect everyone. And to be so evasive and bring examples that are the equivalent of fear-mongering, I don't think that's appropriate in this discussion.
And let's get another comment from Gilson and come back to our guest. 410-319-8888. Gilson, you're on the air.
Yes, how you doing?
Very well.
I'm listening to everyone talk about the cameras. First, I'm a retired Baltimore City police officer. And I have to say, where are the supervisors during all these incidents? Like the police department, these guys are supervising themselves. The first-line supervisor is the most important supervisor of this department. They know their officers. They know who's capable of being a good officer. They know who's capable of being a bad officer. Okay, when a sergeant leaves an officer in charge, that officer is groomed by the sergeant. And he knows that when the sergeant's off, he has to run that squad the same way as the sergeant would run it. If an officer does not listen to what he has to say because he is the supervisor, when the sergeant comes back, he deals with them. I think that a camera does not hold an officer accountable. A supervisor holds their officer accountable. Supervisors within the department have to get back to holding each other accountable. Okay, the canvas is going to cost, it's going to be a heavy price tag. They just got an article in the paper about the internal affairs. How about putting that money in internal affairs and getting them trained and getting them the equipment to be able to address these officers that need to be addressed? I mean, these cameras are not to cure all. It's to get the supervisors back engaged with the officers.
Justin, thanks so much for calling. From your opinion as somebody who's been in the department, and we didn't even get to that point, or the other point you wanted to get to, which was there was a report that just came out by someone who's actually executive director of the Sheriff's Association saying that internal affairs was in disarray, not being able to do its job the way it's structured at the moment, which is very kind of telling, and that's something we need to look at very seriously as well. So, I mean, it seems to me that one of the elephant in the room here for a moment. Is there a problem from any of your perspectives with how police interact with the community of Baltimore City or any other community? You know, we talk about citizens having a citizens review board. We talk about all the other issues you yourself used earlier, Bob Cherry, the question of police brutality. I mean, you came up in your own comments. And by the way, Kay misspoke. You were not talking about comparing this to terrorists. You were talking about something very different, about civil liberties. Post 9/11 was what you were talking about. But do we have a problem in the city? What is that problem? Do cameras address that? How do we get to the heart of what we know happens between officers who do their job every day and try to do the job right? And I say this from somebody whose nephew is a cop, whose former students were cops, and you know that the people I think are decent human beings. But the reality is that the question of power and community, that brutality does exist, that goes overboard with people. What do we have a problem? How do we address that problem then? Is it cameras? What is it? Or do we not think the problem exists?
Well, I've certainly said that cameras are helpful, and definitely there's momentum to move forward with cameras and put proper measures in place to make them work effectively. But certainly it's not the be-all, end-all. And I've consistently said, you know, where there's such great power, there's a great deal of responsibility that's required. Yes, of course, we have a trust problem. We've had a trust problem for a very long time. And while there's been maybe some measures designed to fix the problem, they have been wholly inadequate. There may be some improvements, but they haven't fixed the problem. And they haven't fixed the problem when you still have situations where you have jurors consistently that come into the courtroom and can't serve because they have a fundamental mistrust or distrust for the police and because of experiences that they've had. And, you know, it's not an indictment. I'm not indicting all police. I'm saying it's a culture that has arisen over a long period of time, and it's going to take big steps, giant steps, substantial steps to fix those huge problems. Cameras are one aspect of it, and some other reforms are important too. You briefly brought up the IID issue. Some years ago, I had a bill that wasn't received all that well in Annapolis, but maybe it's time to start talking about it too, which was to bring in independent trial boards specifically for the Baltimore City IID to hear the cases, and that was a result of following the Hobson case and some officers that personally come to me and talked about feeling discriminated against within that department and within that there was disparate treatment for officers within that system, and so that maybe there's time to talk about that. It was my understanding at the time, and I don't know how much it's changed or not changed, that Baltimore was one of the only jurisdictions that really had their trial boards from within, that every member was from within the department. Other ones brought at least one member from outside, from another jurisdiction, to hear it. That's what I was told at the time, so I'm not certain.
Bob Cherry, very quickly, because we only have like a few minutes left, and I do want to get – Jason will have the last word. Bob?
No, I just want to say, you know, just reiterate, this isn't about resistance. This isn't about discussing, you know, what's good and bad about the cameras. I clearly see, and I know there's been many situations. I had a homicide a number of years ago, Jason, where this young man, after he was advised his Miranda rights, confessed to a brutal rape and murder of a young African-American woman who he left just lying in a ditch up off of Pimlico Road in Northwest Baltimore. We had to convince the state's attorney's office then under Pat Chesimy to go forward with this case because it was just going to be my testimony and my partner against this young man, because when we went to put him on tape, he had called one of our bluffs, and I think it was a strategic mistake on my part, I admit that, with a photo array of his conspirator. And when he realized that we had the wrong conspirator, he realized, I just confessed to a murder that I don't have to confess to. So we ended up losing that case in court because there was nothing videotaped. There was nothing recorded. I look at that, Jason. There's something there that I would want, you know, if going back 10 years. But, Mark.
No, we only have a couple
right.
minutes left.
That's, so I guess that's what I'm saying. There is pros and cons to it. I just think that we need to slow down and look right. at this in its totality.
Jason? We have about a minute left, brother.
Yeah, I think we were talking about the review processes and the overall accountability, whether or not it's broken, whether or not there's a mistrust in the community, and there is. We know that the Civilian Review Board doesn't work. We know that Internal Affairs cannot be held to police their own officers. Again, this is officers, even with my case, when I went down to Internal Affairs, I was told by an officer who had 25 years on the force that he didn't believe my story, even though I had medical papers showing laceration, broken nose, things of that nature, showing that I had been abused by the officer. But I was told by the officer in a preliminary investigation, he hadn't even gotten the officer's side of the story yet or the rest of the witness's story yet. But it's the mistrust of the Internal Affairs process. The community doesn't trust that process. When you go to them, nothing never happens. The same officers are back on the streets, and then the citizens fear over them officers because they feel retaliation is going to happen. So the process is broken. We need to review that Internal Affairs process, the Civilian Review Board, and also look at the Officers' Bill of Rights as well as the SOP, the Officers' Standard Operating Procedure, and make sure that there's some compassion, some empathy in policing our community.
So what we'll be doing here in the next few weeks is come back to this, and we've talked to Shelley Greenberg to have him come on the air with us from the Hopkins Police Leadership Program, invite Bob and others back on the program, and Jill and Jason, to have a much longer, maybe 2-hour conversation here about all these aspects, how civilian review boards fit into the Office Bill of Rights, how the cameras fit into all that, and what we have to do to change the nature of policing in the city, and wrestle with the issue of the investigative report that came out about the IAA?
IAD.
Thank you, IAD. And it's not being able to handle its job. There's a lot here to put on the table for the future of our community. We'll come back to all of that. Delegate Jill Carter, always a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for coming in. Bob Cherry, President of FOP, Number 3 Lodge. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Mark.
Jason Rodriguez, one of the co-founders of the Baltimore chapter of Cop Watch. Thank you so much for joining
us
once again.
Thank you, and thank you for everybody's good work, by the way. And good luck, Bob Cherry, in your future endeavors.
Jason, I'll see you in the street, and keep up the go work yourself.
We're taking a quick break and going out with Robert Gillespie's version of Smells Like a Teen Spirit by Nirvana. Their album, Nevermind, came out on this day in 1991. We'll be right back with Baynard Woods, the Baltimore City Paper. It's time to hear what's in it. Stay with us.